And now, welcome our main speaker tonight, Janice R. from Long Beach.
Thank you, thank you. My name is Janice. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be anywhere. Are we going to do birthdays? So what time do I stop? Quarter of. Okay, I can do that, maybe. We'll see. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be anywhere. This is going to work because I can see your eyes. I've spoke at East Bay a couple of times, and I can't see people's eyes from the podium, so I get real spaced. I get real abstract. I need to see you to stay in my own heart and be connected. I'm really having a good time tonight. I feel really welcome. I know a lot of people here, and I feel real safe. Judy was talking about that, you know. I am safe, and I am always safe. I've never been wrapped real tight. I never will be. You know, I lost all my marbles. I got a new set. That's why I pass out marbles on my birthday. It's okay to be crazy. You just don't drink. What I discovered in my journey, I've been sober a long time. My sobriety date is November 11th, 1981. So I'll be 26 this November. And I know I can tell you the story about what happened, and I'll do that, but I have no idea how that happens. I just am, to the bottom of my soul, eternally grateful that I get to be one of the people that gets to live this life. That the loneliness and the despair, that terrible, terrible despair and hopelessness of being drunk and loaded for 12 years. You know, I tell people I was only drunk once, and it lasted 11 years. At the core of that was loneliness and fear, just loneliness and fear. And then to discover that that was the price of being in this world that I didn't even know existed and didn't know to want is just beyond anything I could have imagined. I'm one of God's little whiz kids, and I'm ambidextrous, which means I can do everything with both hands. And I think I'm not left-brained or right-brained or any of that stuff. I just have this big open space I just play around in a lot. And I'm really good at school. That was a coping mechanism. My mom was a school teacher, and she really liked really smart kids. And she was also an alcoholic. And she argued with my dad, and I was a daddy's girl. My dad was my hero. He was just a really, really good man, and I loved him. And she would get drunk, and she would argue with my dad. So, you know, children, we all do the same thing. It's not because we're alcoholics. It's because we're children. I decided that maybe if I was really, really smart and really, really good, that my mom wouldn't drink so much, and then she wouldn't fight with my dad. So I got really good at school. I skipped a few grades. And, of course, what happened is that she drank more and argued with him more, and so I just figured I was a failure. And children do that because we don't have enough. We don't know to ask anybody. If I'd gone to my best friend or my next-door neighbor or anybody and said, is it my fault that my mom drinks? They'd say, no, honey, she had problems before you were born. Go play. But we don't do that. We decide that somehow it must be my fault, and if I can't fix it, there's something wrong with me. And I love my dad so much, and I decided that maybe if I was really, really pretty and I was just oh so cute that he wouldn't be so sad and I could fix his broken heart. And I did everything I knew how to do and could figure out to do, and it's a clever, clever little girl, and he just kept getting sadder and sadder and sadder. So by the time I was 8 years old, I was exhausted. You know that tap dance? I've been dancing as fast as I could for all my life, and it just kept getting worse. I was exhausted, and my mom was drunker, and I'd come home from school, and she'd be passed out, and my dad was sadder, and I just figured I was worthless, and it must all be my fault. And then they decided, I think that it was real innocent. I've done all the work. I'm worth it. I've done all the work there is to do to heal and let go of all that old story. But I think what I did without realizing it is, I think what they did is they looked at me and they said, you know, remember how happy we were when she was born? Maybe if we have another child, it'll happen again. And probably a lot of people have done this. And you think that worked for them? So they had this other child. I was mad at him before I was born. I remember thinking, I don't know how to take care of children. I already can't do all of this. I'm already tired. And then he was born, and of course it didn't fix the marriage, and he got blamed. So in the assignment of roles in the family, I was the hero, I'm the wonderful one, and he's the bad guy. So we did what we were taught, and we both, they're all just coping skills. I was just lucked out because mine are more socially acceptable. I'm not anywhere as near healthier than my brother. I just have different skills. And all of that has nothing to do with alcoholism. I'm really glad I'm an alcoholic. Really, really glad I'm an alcoholic. I managed to be obsessed with you. I'm also in Al-Anon 25 years. But my first song, I called them my oldies but goodies, Radio K-Fuck. I have a whole bunch of songs in the oldies but goodies station. And the original one is, if only I can fix you, then I'll be all right. So that's always my fallback, and which qualifies me for Al-Anon. And then I began to manage and control my eating with a girlfriend. We'd love to not eat for 3 or 4 days and get high off that. So, and then later that one brought me to my knees, and I have 20-something years recovery in Overeaters Anonymous. I have recovery in almost every area of addiction that I showed up. You know, we call it switching seats on the Titanic. The important thing is just don't drink. You know, we just start wherever we are and do that part. And you know, and I my sponsors used to tell me, and I tell the women I work with, you know, if you have to pick up, eat, or take a hostage or something. You know, just don't drink, because when we drink at it to kill our feelings, sometimes we accidentally die. And that's the only really awful part, is people accidentally die just trying to kill the pain. They're not trying to die. They're just trying to kill the pain. And I drank once in high school, and the drink triggered the phenomena of craving, and I drank all I could get hold of, and I blacked out, and I got sick. And I have no idea why I didn't do that again for another 10 years. But during those 10 years, I had active eating disorders, and I like to take hostages, and I like outlaws, and which is a lot of fun for a while. And then it always goes south, and then I switch and find another hostage to take. But by the time I was 27, I had just graduated from Berkeley. I had married an alcoholic and left him, and I was taking another hostage. And I don't remember what triggered it. I had a really good time in Berkeley. I graduated in 1968, and it was about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it was fun. I had a really good time. I was very, very pretty. I had a couple greyhounds, and we just modeled for a living. And I was an art supply, and, you know, life was good. Lived on a commune. Life really was good. It was fun up there. Long Beach is the only other town I've ever lived in where I felt as comfortable as Berkeley. You cannot attract attention in Berkeley or in Long Beach. You know? And that's real comforting. It's impossible to stand out visually in either one of those towns, and that's real comforting. But anyway, well, I don't know what was going on then, but I started drinking wine, and that triggered, you know, I heard it from Judy and from Mary Jo. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my tribe. This is where I belong. I have a right to be here whether you want me here or not, because I don't want to die drunk. I'm home. I've been to meetings everywhere in the world. I've never been around human beings that nod when I talk. The earth people, and I'm around a lot of earth people. I pass for normal in a lot of situations. But if I talk to them the way I talk to you, their heads go this way. And you guys nod this way. You know? So I started being taken to counselors when I was a young woman, and I've been in and out of therapy all my life. I'm just under a lot of fear, a lot of pressure. I'm dissociative schizophrenic, and I've had a few psychotic breaks. And I don't mind being crazy. I'm harmless. But the transition from here to there is pretty much of a nightmare. So anyway, in 1969 or 1970, I'm not sure when, I took a drink of wine, and it triggered the phenomena of craving, which I have the allergy to alcohol. And that is not alcoholism. It's just one of the characteristics. if I had an allergy to strawberries, I wouldn't eat strawberries, right? I have an allergy to alcohol. Every time I drink, I don't know how much I'm going to drink or where it's going to take me. And almost every time I drink, I black out. And I drank around the clock. And I managed my alcoholism with speed. And that's what I did for 11 years. And the only time I wasn't drinking and speeding is if I was in jail. And every time I was in jail, I was loaded before I got home. I had to medicate in order to pass for normal. And I could pass for normal when I was, I mean, I used my alcohol and drugs like psych meds. And I could pass for normal. I went to, I mean, I couldn't keep good jobs, but I could get really good ones. And I went to a lot of school. I, you know, educated way beyond my ability to learn. And I just couldn't keep good jobs. The best job I ever had in my disease was my son's father, and you touched my heart, Michelle. My son's father was I got in a lot of trouble for stealing money out of somebody's account. And I didn't go to prison because I'm crazy. They don't put people like me in prison. So I ended up with summary probation and restitution. So my son's father and I moved to the Valley because, of course, there's no liquor stores or connections out there, right? And I went to school out there because that's what I do. Every time my life, I mean, I'm really overeducated, and it has nothing to do with wanting to be anybody. It has to do with it's all I'm really good at. So every time my life fell apart, which was a lot, I went back to school. So I did that in Northridge. I went to their graduate school and majored in psychology because that's what I always do, because that's what we do, try to figure out what's wrong with us so we can get it fixed. And the problem with that kind of thinking, of course, is that there was never anything wrong with me. So I can't get it fixed. It's just all this crazy thinking that I got in the habit of thinking. And out in Northridge, I got involved with some people that were putting together a program for people to come out of prison and go to college, and I helped write the grant for that, get it funded, and then I got hired as the grad assistant part-time, and I just had a ball, and I had a really good time doing that. Concurrent with that, my son's father was also a very violent alcoholic, and it's a really sweet, important part of my story, because I don't know anything about violence. I was never even spanked. And I got into this dance. I think it's a dance. It takes two people. I don't think there's good guys and bad guys. And I got into this dance with him. We'd be drinking and using, and he'd go into a blackout, and he'd hit me or beat me up or something like that. And it was just totally shocking. I had no idea what to do. And then he'd be heartbroken, just heartbroken and sobbing. And he really was. It was because he would never hurt me on purpose. But for some, it's a human thing. We always, the people that we love the most are the ones that see the ugly side of us. And I did what most people do that get into that cycle of abuse. I got more secretive. I stopped seeing my friends. I stopped telling the truth to anybody and drank more and used more. And he did the same thing. And that triggers it to happen again. And we got into that cycle, and it happened 3 or 4 times. But meanwhile, I got pregnant with Damon, and he was about 5 or 6 weeks old, and Chester was, we were both drinking, but he was drunk and in a blackout, and he started chasing me. He was going to really hurt me, and I was holding the baby, and he caught me, and he knocked me down, and I didn't drop my baby, but I broke my arm. And so I knew I had to get out of there to protect this little boy. And what always touches me so deeply is, and my son has never owed me anything, he saved my life. I did not know at that moment in time that I was worth saving. If it hadn't been for that baby, I would have continued to think it was my fault. I didn't love him enough. I didn't love him right. And I would have gone back again. But I left, and I never went back because I had to protect that baby. And then, of course, I know now that I'm every bit as important as that child, in God's eyes anyway. But I didn't start off that way. If any of you newcomers, especially the new women, probably can't even imagine thinking that they're worth anything. My early sponsors had me start off by, you know, you hear us talking about fake it till you make it. They had me start off with pretending that I was at least as valuable as my cat. So, and I could do that, you know, that maybe in God's eyes I was at least worth giving good food to and being kind to, instead of, you know, I just hated myself so much. So anyway, I came to Long Beach, and I had been interviewing at Cal State Long Beach, and I got hired to be the director of their ex-offender program. It's called Project Chance. And Nap Harris was my boss. Jack Shainline was his boss, who's the vice president of student affairs, who's in Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, so I got hired to run that program. And I had picked Chester the day he got out of Terminal Island. I really like outlaws. And so then, and then if only he'd have straightened up, then I'd have been all right. It's kind of a drunken island on dance thing. So then when I got to Long Beach, I took another hostage the day he got out of Soledad and became the coordinator of that program at Cal State Long Beach for 2 years. And the whole time my disease kept getting uglier and uglier and uglier. And it had, I mean, being an alcoholic, being an addict is being a slave. I was completely enslaved. Whatever it said to do, I did it so that I could have access to my drugs and my alcohol. And it came before everything. And I wasn't given tenure at the university, smart of them. I'm a risk manager's nightmare. And then my life spiraled out. Then none of these, quote, romances I ever got into lasted more than, I mean, the good times only lasted maybe a year, and then it was kind of miserable for a year, and then it was awful for a year. And I finally left that man because it was emotionally abusive, and it was scary for me. So, but then my alcoholism and my addiction went, just spiraled out of control because I was working for the Census Bureau, which is there's no structure at all. You get to work whenever you want, and you work alone, and I couldn't work more than 3 or 4 hours. I'd be too drunk to drive. And of course, if I was drinking, I was driving, and you know, that's why they put lines in the road, is so you can close one eye and stay on the high. You know, it's like just what I did. So I guess God loves drunks and babies. But anyway, in 19, Deborah and I have a really good mentor friend in our life, Ron Banner, and he, I told you about having some experiences with psychosis. I was in a horrible, horrible, seedy apartment at 10th and Washington, and I had been, at that point, I'd been slamming methadrine for a year or two, and I was drinking around the clock, you know, Mad Dog 2020, really classy drinker, right? Awful stuff. But it gets you there fast. I mean, alcohol did for me what spinach did for Popeye. It never, you know, I heard Judy say, it never stopped working. Boom, chaka, and it would just fill all those empty, dark places, just for a minute, at least. But I started, I don't know what was going on, and I never have been raptural tight, and I started, and I looked out the windows, or I didn't look out the windows, I peeked through the blinds, right? It was more like it. And there was these, like, animated critters, like Roger Rabbit and horses and alligators, and they were doing cartwheels and somersaults and stuff from car to car, and they were just having a grand old time. And I didn't imagine that you would probably be able to see them too, and so I didn't want to be that crazy. I didn't want anybody to know that I was that crazy. I was used to keeping it hidden pretty well. And so I looked in the telephone book in the yellow pages, because I've always run to shrinks. And to be honest, none of them ever did me any good, but none of them ever did me any harm either. And our book talks about that. Part of the problem with that is that I never really told them the truth. I wanted the counseling and my alcohol. You know, because I couldn't, drinking is the only time I ever felt whole and complete. I'm not giving that up for anybody or anything. But anyway, turned out, which is one of those God-sidences we experience in recovery, that he also was, he knew what to do with people who drank, and he also is an alcoholic. And I told him the truth for the first time in my life. And somehow he took me to Wayne Fanning Institute, which is a detox place in Whittier, I think. Maybe. Anybody know where it is? I don't know where it is. Whittier. And I stayed the weekend. I just had a wonderful time. It was like Girl Scout camp. I just loved it. And a speaker came in who was from Latin America. He was an MD. And he had us falling out of the chairs laughing at the terrible things he'd done with his patients' medication. And, you know, I mean, he was really funny. And I hadn't laughed. I was talking with somebody about that earlier. I hadn't laughed in 20, 30 years. Not really laughed. And I laughed on that weekend. And I came home from that weekend and picked right up where I left off. But I think what happened is it let the very first teeny tiny little light in my heart that maybe, just maybe. So what happens is my mom got sober when I was 16. And I didn't like her any better sober than I did drunk. And that was, you know, we hear, I might be the first, the only copy of the big book you ever see. You know, I didn't want anything she had. And I didn't like the people she brought around. And it never occurred to me that you guys were there. I didn't know anything was, I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous was any bigger than what I experienced with my mom. And I would have never come here because I thought I already knew. But I think that that little sober weekend, and people were really good to me, and they suggested maybe I might want to get some outside help. But they were really good to me, and I was welcome, and they were kind, and I had fun. I really had fun. And I think it just planted a little light, a little teeny tiny light of hope in my heart. And I went back and kept doing what I was doing. And I took a PACE exam, a Federal Professional Administrative Career Exam. I got picked up by the Internal Revenue Service as a revenue officer. Anyway, life is funny. Thank God to Betty Ford, I owe her my life, absolutely. Betty Ford made alcoholism a treatable disease and made it a federal management policy to do interventions on their alcoholics, and there I was. By that last year, that was 1981, that last year I was, I only keep really two little video clips of my drunkalog. One of them is probably 1980, sitting on Pacific, just this south side of the 405 in whatever car it was an old Rambler. Broad daylight, I'd been up for days, I was tied off, I had a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 between my legs, I was crying. My son was in the back seat, and he was about three. And he was patting me on the shoulder saying, Mommy, don't cry, I'll take care of you. And I keep that because that's not his job. I'm supposed to be the mom. He's not supposed to be taking care of me. I'll tell you about him in a minute. He did really good stuff with his adult child stuff. He was in training with me, and he's made a whole career out of it. He's a rescue swimmer and instructor for SAR for the Navy and a pilot and... Anyway, he's made a whole life out of rescuing people, so I figure. But he's had a sober mom for 25 years. He's 30 now, so instead of being an orphan. And the other one is that last year, that 1981, how many times I woke up in a wet bed and crawled into the kitchen looking for the hair of the dog that bit me, just something to take the edge off, or into the bathroom to find the cottons from the night before, the day before, or both. And stopped at the liquor store on my way to work, bought a half pint of vodka because I drank everything I had. I am a pig. I'm that way about recovery, too, so I'm really glad I'm so greedy. I want it all, and I can have it all. So I never bought more than a half pint because I couldn't not drink all I had. And then I'd buy another half pint at lunch and another one on the way home and another one to go to sleep on. And that's a horrible, dark, gray circle to live in day after day after day after day. And I never talked to any other human being except my son. He was a little boy. And that's how I would live. And I had just, I'd given away everything for my right to drink. And they did an intervention on me. And I've told you, you know, I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. They did an intervention on me, and this classic, if you've ever seen the movies, they sat me down at the end of a big, humongous table, and they sat at the other end, and they presented all this evidence. And my choices were to be asked to resign that day or to go into a treatment program for 30 days with full benefits and full pay. So it was a very easy choice. I had no intention of not drinking. But I just wanted to keep my job because it cost a lot of money to live the way I was living. And I ended up sober, so go figure. I know that my motives were nothing but manipulative. They've always been. That's who I am. Before I make any kind of commitment, I always know the way out. I had a friend bring me a handful of Black Beauties halfway into that 30-day program. So that's where my motives were, and I ended up sober anyway. So, you know, go figure. By the grace of God, pure grace of God, I ended up at the round table because, well, I say I got out of the hospital in December and I went back to work. In April, I was asked to resign sober and crazy. I was speaking in tongues. I couldn't speak English very well, and I was in a hovercraft. I went to work in a spaceship. So it's really smooth, no traffic. And it was in Carson. So that was real devastating to me at the time because I was such a house of cards. I needed to be somebody because there was nobody home. There was no Janice. There was no Janice. I am such a chameleon. I can slip inside of you and know as much about you as you do in 24 hours, and I'll be whatever you need me to be. But that's the only identity I had. I didn't have a real me or my own me or a me in God. And so it was devastating not to have a title or anybody to be. All I got to be, and God didn't let me go back to work for 2.5, almost 3 years. And all I got to be was a woman in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous and a mom. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me. The best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life. And I, pure luck, I got to go to the round table. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the round table, but it's the only place I've ever been since where I would have been okay. I like men, they like me, and it's real laid back. There's not a lot of this high-pitched chitter-chatter and not a lot of hugging and kissing and shaking hands. It's just, you know, have a cup of coffee, sit down, make yourself comfortable. It's okay if you come late. It's okay if you leave early. And we're glad you're here. How you doing, Janice? Welcome back. I hope we see you again tomorrow. Real laid back. And I just loved them. And outrageous drunkologues just had me howling and laughing. And I found a place where I could fit in. And I did that. And then I felt, and then I was at Thursdays when they were getting together, and that's where I met Joanne Burke and Valerie, and they sponsored me together for the first year. And they just kept me busy. And I got to, and that's where Greg came in my life, and we started trudging and riding bicycles. You know, whatever we do, we overdo it. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing, right? So we rode bikes on 100-mile rides and went backpacking every month with a group of people who still backpack every month, by the way, and have a meeting on the top of a mountain. We went last month. And that's all I did for 2.5 years is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found my sponsor. What happened is there was a lady at the round table that asked me one day if I was willing. I hate that word. You know, I know it's a trap every time. If I was willing to go to a woman's meeting with her. And everything in my entire body screamed no, but my mouth said yes. Now, I don't like women. I don't trust them. I have no idea how to be a woman. And I don't know anything about emotional availability or intimacy with women because my mom wasn't emotionally available at all. She just wasn't emotionally present. She never hugged us or held us. She'd just say, don't cry, let's go shopping. Don't cry, have something to eat. So I went to what we call grandma's meeting. They all have blue hair and they knit. No, that isn't true, but it looked like it at the time. It's on Wednesday at 10 o'clock on Terminal at the Episcopal Church. And I stayed there long enough to get to belong. And I found a sponsor there I did my first fifth step with. I've done a few since. And had a spiritual experience sufficient to stay sober. Everybody's experience is different. I read this horrible, pitiful, dark, self-blaming, self-hatred, this horrible story. And she just loved me and put her arms around me, and she got a book of Spiritual Games by Hugh Prather. And we both picked a game to play, and for months I walked around, and my game was, and it was just totally perfect for me. The game I picked was I have two faucets. You can't see them, but they're here. And they stick out the side of my head, and I can turn them on any time I want. And they spray golden light, and I go, whoosh, whoosh. And I just did that for months. And what a wonderful thing to do for somebody like me, because if she had talked to me, I would have intellectualized it, because I intellectualize everything. That's what my brain does. You know, that's what it was trained to do. And it doesn't, and I have a wonderful mind, but it doesn't know it isn't plugged into anything. It doesn't know that it doesn't know. It's just busy thinking and having opinions all the time, just chatter. Blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't know that it doesn't know. So it was the perfect thing for her to do for someone like me, because she bypassed my brain and went straight to my heart. And then I got my first job in recovery was in the 1984 Olympics, and I got to work at El Dorado Park because I could ride my bike down Los Coyotes and get there really, really early. And my very first job was to feed the ducks, because the ducks all wanted to go down this street And there was a gate across it, and that was where the athletes came in. It was an archery venue. So my job was to go up there with all this duck food and lead them to another place. It was really fun. They'd all follow me along, all these little ducks. I got to do that every morning about 5:30. It was just delightful. And it was a sweet experience because I look back now and realize I had no self-esteem because there was no Janice. I couldn't believe anybody would pay me to be anywhere. And I had been paid lots of money to do all kinds of fancy academic professional stuff, but that was all fake because I'm an actress. This was really me they hired, and it was just really sweet. From there, I went to work for the city of Los Angeles because I had taken another exam for them. And I told you I went back to school every time my life fell apart. Well, I went back to school as soon as I got sober. And I got a master's in public administration, and the city of Los Angeles picked me up. And it was just during the heyday. You know, Betty Ford started that thing rolling where it was okay to have alcoholics working, and everybody was on that same wagon of giving treatment to their alcoholics. And we had meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at noon every day. Doug was there with me on some of them because he's from the LA Times. Starting in 1984, I went to 5 meetings a week and without ever going to one in Long Beach. We had 3 AA meetings a week, an Al-Anon meeting, and an OA meeting every noon. Councilman Ferraro's off at the Federal Building, Parker Center in the basement, and the LA Times, thanks to Doug. And it was just wonderful. We had a whole band of people in recovery. Well, because I was in recovery and going to meetings with the sober cops, I got hired by LAPD. Now, this is as a manager. I mean, as a beginning, whatever you call them, entry-level manager. Or actually, it was a first promotion. So the important thing about this story is not that I worked for LAPD, which is outrageously fun, but it is that to never limit yourself to what you think is possible, because we don't have a clue. I'm an alcoholic and a dope fiend. I have a criminal record, and I got hired by LAPD. Now, to this day, that was in 1986 when they hired me in from another department. Whoever's the chief now, Bratton, I guess it is, will tell you they've never hired a dope fiend, and they absolutely have never hired anybody with a criminal record. And I'll tell you that my God either didn't know or didn't give a shit. I worked for them for 14 years, and I retired from LAPD as a mid-level manager, and I was outrageously successful. And the center of my appeal to them is that I'm a woman in recovery. I was trained as a peer counselor. I was trained as a certified interventionist. I was trained as a critical response team person, a crisis intervention. I had the best training in the world. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and my recovery. And I just had so much fun. And I got to be in Parker Center that whole time. And I have 3 minutes. It's not going to work. I have one amends story I want to tell you because you cannot know how important it is just to do it, whether you want to or not. Just set aside what you think and do it anyway. You know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and if you don't like the results, you can say, see, I told you so. But we know that contempt prior to investigation will kill us. You know, contempt prior to investigation is me and my defiant 2-year-old self saying, I'm not going to do that. Have you ever had any? No. Do you know anything about it? No. Why don't you want it? I just know. Right? That's contempt prior to investigation. You know, dive in, and if you don't like it, at least you can be right. But please don't die before you've even given it a chance. I retired from LAPD. I'm not going to tell you the amends story because I don't have time. I retired from LAPD in 1998, and I had gone back to school and got another degree because I didn't like them anymore, and I knew that I had changed. They hadn't. I am always what changes. I used to be a victim. Now I'm a volunteer. I know that nobody ever did anything to me. I put myself in positions so I could blame you for feeling sorry for me. And I am a volunteer for my life. I've co-created my life with God, and I love my life. And if I don't like what's going on, I do something different, and I get different results. If you're doing it to me, I'm screwed. If I'm doing it to me, I'm teachable and I could do something different. It's real simple. Real simple. So I've really, in recovery, become a powerful woman because I know I'm powerless. And I know how to take contrary action and do what it takes to not be in the problem. And so I left there in 1998, and I went to work for DCFS for 4 years, and then I went to work with Deborah for 2 or 3 years, and Now I'm pretty much always a social worker and a therapist, and that isn't what comes first in my life. What comes first in my life is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do Ashtanga yoga 5 or 6 times a week because I'm worth it and I love how I feel. And it would really piss me off to be this happy and start being sick. Now that I finally can't wait to wake up in the morning because I just love my life instead of, oh, life is so hard and they're picking on me, you know, the Ellen on Swang Song. You know, I just would piss me off to start getting sick and ill now. So I take really, really good care of me because I'm worth it and because I actually believe that you love me. And I know how painful it is when people I love die and they leave. And I don't want to do that to you either. I stayed single and celibate for 19 years because I wanted a real me that was okay, whole and complete, me and God. And then Jim came in my life, and he's a wonderful, good man, and we're both in recovery, and we have a really good time together. But I'll never get lost, and I'll never get confused, because I have Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have God, and I'm safe. For the first time in my life, I'm safe, and I will always be safe. Thank you.